Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
I'm Caleb Zachrin, the assistant editor of the New Books Network, and you're listening to New Books in American Politics. Today I'm speaking with Professor Corey Robin about his book, The Enigma of Clarence Thomas, published by Metropolitan Books. Corey is Distinguished Professor of Political Science at Brooklyn College and the CUNY Graduate Center. In this book, he analyzes the life and thought of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. Corey makes the case that Justice Thomas is not only one of the most influential people in American politics today, but that his worldview is also deeply misunderstood. Corey, thank you so much for joining me today on the New Books Network.
Thanks so much for having me. Glad to be here.
So the first question I'd like to ask you, and it's always the first question I ask, is if you could just tell me a little about your background and what made you decide to write a book about Clarence Thomas.
Well, I'm a political scientist and have written quite a bit about reactionary politics over the years. And I didn't go seeking out this topic. It kind of came to me. There was a group of people, two political scientists who were doing an anthology of African American political thought, and they wanted somebody to write something about Clarence Thomas. And they turned to me because I had written about the right, and I thought I was finished with the right. But I agreed to do it somewhat reluctantly and was really surprised by what I found out, both about Thomas's background and his life story, but also the connection between that life story and his actual jurisprudence. And it was such a surprise and unanticipated story that I felt like there was something there that had to be told to a wider audience.
Yeah. So most of your work, you wrote another book, The Reactionary Mind, which is a really interesting collection of essays about American conservatism. And I'm wondering, just sort of generally, before diving into Thomas, you know, what is it about this subject that you find so fascinating? And you know, how would you sort of characterize the perspective you take on conservatism? Because I think that you have a approach to thinking about conservative thought that is, you know, I don't know, maybe a little bit more different in certain ways, can be sympathetic, but also interestingly critical. How would you sort of characterize your perspective?
Well, yeah, I'm someone on the left, and I quite a bit older than you are. I was born in 1967 and came of age during the late 1970s and the early Reagan era. So conservatism and the right were really part of the world that I grew up in, and never really thought that much about, to be honest with you. But increasingly, as I began to study the right, I realized that people didn't, I thought people were really getting the right wrong, as it were, and that many of the themes that I think are of interest, both politically and intellectually, to the left, were being pursued with a lot more aplomb on the right. I mean, this is really in the 1990s and in the aughts. This is all, you know, pre-Occupy, pre-even Obama, when, you know, the entire world of the left was circumscribed by Bill and Hillary Clinton. So it seemed to me that both the fact that the right was misunderstood, many people, both on the right and the left, talked about the right as the kind of the responsible ruling class, the people who are reality-based, as opposed to the utopian hippie wannabes of the left. And I felt like that was completely wrong, that really did not understand the very utopian dimensions of the right, the very radical dimensions of the right, the extraordinarily ideological dimensions of the right, the movement element of the right. Now, a lot of this stuff now, I think, seems, utopian, not so much, but ideology, movement, the radicalism, that all seems sort of obvious. But that was not the case as recently as my book, The Reactionary Mind, came out in 2011, and it was greeted with a lot of hostility, particularly from liberals. So I would say, as recently as 10 years ago, people didn't see those dimensions of the right. So that's really what I focused on. And then one other thing I should say about my approach to the right is that where conservatives and analysts of conservatism will talk about the right as either a kind of commitment to freedom, individual freedom, as opposed to collectivist or state freedom, or traditionalist or prudential, all of these watchwords that the right has developed over the years, I think the fundamental issue around which the right organizes and understands itself even is as an oppositional move, a counter movement to movements of emancipation, of social emancipation from below. And I trace this going back to Edmund Burke and the French Revolution.
I think that this book on Clarence Thomas is interesting because, as you reveal in the book, Thomas's views as a child and as a young man were not the views that he has now. He still contains a lot of the threads that he would begin to develop in college. But how would you sort of, describe Thomas's childhood and his early years, his sort of early political consciousness? What was that like for him?
Well, Thomas was born in 1946 or 48, I can't remember the exact year, in Pinpoint, Georgia, which is a small coastal town along the Atlantic seaboard, not that far from Savannah. It was a town that was founded by formerly enslaved people after the Civil War. He was born into poverty. His father left him when he was very young. And was raised by his mother, he and his brother and his sister. And when he was around 5 or 6 years old, she just couldn't support her children anymore. So he and his brother went to live with his grandfather. And this was probably the most formative, significant event in his life. His grandfather was also from a fairly poor working class background, but had willed himself to become what we'd call a small business owner. He was a fuel delivery, owned his fuel delivery business, and then ended up being quite successful, ended up owning property in Savannah. So became a man of some means, but never lost contact with that background he had. And he was a man of iron will and discipline. He was a very stern patriarchal figure. He had extraordinarily strict rules, and he terrified the crap out of Clarence Thomas. You get hints that Thomas really loathed him in many ways as he was growing up. But as he became older, Thomas really came to appreciate this man as the man who had saved his life, basically, precisely through that iron will, that discipline, and that the terror that he inflicted. Thomas felt that that man had created the seeds of his own self, his own will to power, as it were. He ends up going to Catholic school. His grandfather's Catholic. And in 1968 is recruited to come to Holy Cross in the north, in Worcester, outside of Boston. And it's a Catholic school, a Catholic university that is integrating. And Thomas is part of a fairly remarkable group of young Black men who are first or second year students that are recruited. I think there were about 18 of them, who several of whom become quite famous and successful in their own right. And Thomas becomes a campus militant. He is one of the founders of the Black Student Union, and becomes the secretary treasurer of the Black Student Union. And they are committed to, you know, this is 1968, 1969. This is the civil, you know, we have now passed the peak of the civil rights movement, which is really 1968. Martin Luther King has been assassinated. Malcolm X has been assassinated. Bobby Kennedy has been assassinated. All the landmark pieces of legislation that are going to pass have been passed. So it's a kind of a sour moment, I think, for the Black freedom struggle that continues. And so you see this in the kind of campus politics. It's much more separatist. The very fact that they call themselves a Black Student Union, I mean, Black was still a kind of a term of art that, you know, had migrated from the West Coast. It had a more militant sound to it than, you know, Negro or some of the other terms. And they are committed, like I said, to, to kind of black separatism is too strong at this point, but, they, you know, are in favor of, you know, course, you know, some of the, what will become standard demands of Black students in colleges everywhere, Black literature, more Black professors, more Black students, but also, you know, Black dormitories, Black, you know, separate organizations for Black people. And they type up a kind of manifesto that has several, you know, kind of a comprehensive set of points and planks. And one of them is you know, against interracial romance, interracial dating. And Thomas is one of the most militant, by the way, on this particular topic. He would go around campus and he would call out couples that were interracial couples that he would see. He also leads, you know, what's considered to be the most important demonstrations, a campus walkout of Black students in protest of what's going on with General Electric and their recruitment practices at the college. So he is, he's out there, you know, Malcolm X posters on the wall. He memorizes Malcolm X speeches by listening to records, you know, back then this is pre-internet, pre-CDs, you know, and all that. You'd get records where you'd listen to speeches and he would memorize them and still know them years later. And he reads Malcolm X. He's involved in a school breakfast program modeled on the Black Panthers. He goes to demonstrations in DC and in New Haven, in Boston, some violent demonstrations, and is really steeped in the philosophy of essentially Black nationalism, kind of Black separatism and Black nationalism. So I'll stop right there because I've gone on quite a bit. But that sets you up for the story of Clarence Thomas.
Yeah, I think that, you know, this root of this kind of intellectual flowering for him in Black nationalism was, you know, in many ways it's some of the most fascinating parts of the book that you discuss. And I think that it's interesting because I think a lot of people, especially in, you know, in maybe the circles that Thomas would have been in Yale and other liberal elite intellectual circles, wouldn't have had the same kind of knowledge or understanding of Black nationalism. So, you know, what is Black nationalism and what are some of the core ideas in it and who are the central thinkers of Black nationalism?
So Black nationalism is a philosophy, a politics, a practice that goes back to the 19th century, takes root in the United States. You know, it has multiple strands and dimensions. A formative one is just the idea that Black people form a distinct and separate culture that is And in more radical forms, you know, which should take the form of a nation state, either a state apart from the United States, apart from the territorial United States, whether it be in Liberia or in other parts of Africa or in the Caribbean, or what was called the, later came to be called the Black Belt, a sort of a sovereign subunit of states on the continental United States. Since it's such a loose term that takes different forms over time, and I really want to stress this because it's critical to understanding Thomas's nationalism, is that the Black nationalism of the 1840s and the 1850s doesn't look like the Black nationalism in the 1890s or the 1920s, which doesn't look like the Black nationalism of the 1960s and the 1970s. So people have specific ideas of what Black nationalism is, but like any other ideology, it changes across time. And so to focus on one specific form is mistaken. But what I would say, and I follow the philosopher Tommy Shelby in this regard, is that, you know, Black nationalism is ultimately a view that Black fate, the fate of Black people in the United States, both as individuals and as collective, is apart from, will be determined separately from the fate of the rest of America, whether that be white, brown, or other ethnic groups in America. So it's a sense of apartness, and a sense that Black fate is separate. I'll stop right there.
And when Thomas sort of first becomes a Black nationalist or starts to, you know, read a lot of this material and you know, participate in the Black Student Union. At this point, he still does not identify as a conservative. This is something that's kind of separate from a particular political identity. He still is, would you say at this point, he identifies with the left?
Oh, definitely. The kind of range, both the range of the activities and people's memories of him, these are not necessarily people who are his allies, by the way. These are also people who are critics from him and of independent, you know, journalists who have written about this moment in time in the archival record. He definitely identifies the left. You can see a photograph of him leading a walkout, you know, with the Black Power salute like this and the Black Beret. So he has both the style, the iconography, he, after the walkout, he writes an article in the student newspaper, you know, where he says this was a kind of collective moment of the Black man's liberation. So, and the fact that it was a walkout, not a sit-in, you know, which is what some other Black students were proposing, he said, no, you know, we have to demonstrate that we are not a part of this institution. And it was very important to him that they left the campus, that they made palpable the absence of Black faces on the campus. So that was definitely the style and mode of his thinking as an undergraduate, and that he brings, and that it continues actually in ways when he goes to Yale Law School in 1971, he becomes more heterodox in his thinking, but you know, he has the Pan-African flag flying in his apartment, dresses again in the style of, I wouldn't say Black nationalist anymore, but of a kind of Southern Black man apart from the rest of the community.
Yeah, how does his experience at Yale shape him? Speaking of that, like you mentioned, that he starts to identify or cast himself as not a Northerner. What's his kind of his sense of North versus South, and how does his perception of Northern liberal elites kind of shape his views and ultimately his eventual turn to being conservative?
The way he narrates it is that in the South, he had known obviously racism and the color line. It was obvious. It was overt. White people were white people. The North was a more confusing place for him. Like many Southern Black students who go North to college, this is a fairly common experience. They go North thinking they're heading to the promised land. And After all, you know, they've been recruited as Black students. They've been told, you know, you're welcome here. We want you to come here. But then they have experiences like what he had at Holy Cross, where white students were, they were asked, are you willing to have a Black roommate? Black students were never asked that question. White students were surveyed and at Holy Cross, and they, you know, fairly large number of them would say things like Black people smell differently and all the rest of it. So it was that the dissonance or the disparity between a kind of overt welcoming and an overt rejection of the Southern color line with the reality that's all too familiar of white racism. So much so that years later, you know, when the Boston busing riots happened in 1975, you know, none of this comes as a surprise to him because he will feel like he experienced a racism in the North that was far more pernicious and corrosive than that which he saw in the South. And he will ultimately use a metaphor that is quite similar to the metaphor that Malcolm X used to distinguish between Northerners, or a certain kind of a Northern racist versus Southern racist. Thomas refers to, you know, that Northern racists are like water moccasins, you know, which I don't know much about snakes, but I gather that they seem kind of relatively harmless and innocuous, but are, you know, quite dangerous, whereas Southern racists are like copperheads. And, you know, Malcolm X will talk about foxes versus wolves. You know, one kind of animal doesn't seem so dangerous, but is quite lethal. The other is overtly dangerous, and you know to steer clear from. And that's his understanding. This is exacerbated even more so at Yale. Thomas again is recruited to Yale, and he gets there as part of a affirmative action program, a much more stringent affirmative action program than the one that had preceded in earlier classes. And he feels like he is constantly being reminded of this, that he is there by the grace and the good wishes of white people, that white benevolence is the source of his success. And he makes a comment. He said, you know, whatever I achieved, whatever any of us achieved in the South, nobody could ever say it was because of white people. It was in spite of white people. And whether it was as an individual or as a collective. In the North, all of our achievements, individually and collectively, were tainted as the product of white benevolence. And he, you know, makes a parallel. During the days of slavery and enslavement, you may not have been enslaved, but by virtue of being Black, you were still tarnished with the stain of enslavement and the shame and the scar and the sin that went with that, regardless of whether you were free or enslaved. And likewise, he would make this case, in, you know, quite famously on the Supreme Court, that affirmative action tarnishes all Black students, whether they are there as affirmative action students or not. And this was very much his experience at Yale University, and something he takes with him, you know, and never gets over, essentially.
You've talked about it quite a bit, but, you know, I want to ask, you know, I guess more pointedly, like, you know, what does Thomas see as racism in America? Like, does he think of racism as structural racism? Is racism just individually in people's hearts? Is it cultural? You know, what is Thomas's real view on the source of racism? If there's a solution to racism, if he sees that there's a solution, and also, you know, you've mentioned it with affirmative action a little bit. You know, what role does he see race playing in the Constitution?
There's a lot in those in that question.
Yeah, take it whatever direction you'd like.
I would say the first thing is that he thinks that racism has undiscoverable roots, and because those roots are undiscoverable, you know, it's essentially rootless. It cannot be uprooted. So there is a very pessimistic, very transhistorical understanding of racism, almost as a kind of psychological attitude, as an attitude, attitudinal. But unlike a lot of conservatives who will focus on, you know, if they even acknowledge it, conscious bias, Thomas is very sympathetic to the idea that there are, which is that racism is essentially a form of unconscious bias. And he has affirmed this again and again and again in his Supreme Court opinions. And this is important because this is the dominant model in all the kind of social psychology of racism is that it's the form of, you know, unconscious bias. So it is rootless and therefore transhistorical. It is rooted in, it often takes an unconscious form. And then the last thing that I would say about it, and again, this connects him, I think, with a lot of mainstream views about race in the social sciences, is that it takes its form, not just unconsciously, but as a stigma. It is a way of viewing Black people as essentially stigmatized as less than. And that something like affirmative action, he's, you know, very clear on this, does not create racism in America, which is what a lot of conservatives would say. Thomas is quite clear that racism predates affirmative action, but that affirmative action reinforces and, in fact, is the most common form, he would say today, of racism, because it's the most common form of the perpetuation of stigmas as Black people less capable, as less able. Now, you know, anybody who pays attention to these things or pays attention to his opinions, it'll see, you know, this is a kind of stigma that affects a certain class of Black people. It's not, you know, it's not something that takes its form in police bias, for instance. Thomas, you know, is almost, you know, systemically uninterested. We'll get into that issue later. It's more complicated than that. But it takes its form in places like universities, certain kind of professional managerial workplaces, where affirmative action, as it's contemporarily understood, is most pervasive. So I would say those are kind of the key elements. It's rootlessness and therefore its permanence and transhistorical nature, its unconsciousness, and that it really expresses itself as a stigma of a way of viewing people unconsciously or not as less capable and less able than.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Something that you discuss, and I think that, you know, this relates to Thomas's views on, you know, the role of race and the government, is that Thomas starts to develop a sort of deep suspicion of the government and the ability for the government to address issues of racism. But he seems to have a more optimistic view of the market. So how does Thomas sort of come around on from being someone on the left to someone who starts to embrace capitalism and free market? And obviously, you know, he becomes, ends up being and sort of becomes put in a place to eventually be on the Supreme Court through being in the Reagan administration, which is, you know, of course, one of the most free market, ideologically free market oriented administrations in, you know, political history. But how does Thomas sort of develop a pro-capitalistic view and a suspicion of the government?
Well, I think we should actually start with the very Black nationalism that we mentioned earlier. And again, I think this is where people have a lot of either romantic or superficial understandings of Black nationalism. But Black nationalists have always had a fairly skeptical view of the American government. Marcus Garvey, you know, notorious, most famously, but also Malcolm X. And I've also had a kind of sympathetic view of the market. You know, parts of the autobiography of Malcolm X, he talks about, you know, the importance of things like Black-owned businesses, patronizing, you know, Black products, Black produce, you know, and Black hiring Black workers and so forth. And so this has always been a part of the Black nationalist tradition, a skepticism of the state and an embrace of the market or Black capitalism. But in the moment that Thomas is a militant on the left, you know, the freedom struggle, as I said, is really going through a slow awakening to defeat. This is not 1965. It's not 1964. It's, you know, 1968 with the election of Richard Nixon, and then the re-election in 1972. This is this moment where, you know, the historiography shows that Black activists, Black people who were involved in the struggle really felt like, okay, the heyday is over. You know, this moment is this sense of defeat, the sense that we have among Black people that we have to take care of ourselves. And a real, the sense of defeat is much broader. It's not simply that the state isn't going to, the national state isn't going to do anything for you. It's that politics can't do anything for you. And by politics, I mean everything from protest politics to social movements to more radical forms of, you know, violence and black political activity. So, you know, that's the shadow that hangs over everything. And then meanwhile, a lot of local Black activists who are self-identified Black nationalists, Black power activists, are involved in economic experiments where they are trying to create the institutions of Black capitalism. So, you know, pushing for things like loans for small business, you know, sometimes it can take the form of cooperatives and collectives, but nevertheless, it's trying to create a separate Black economy. So this is really the context in which Clarence Thomas was part of the left. And so once he starts reading more and reading, in particular, one person who was really an influence on him was Thomas Sowell, the economist, Black economist, who's you know, wrote this remarkable book on called Race and Economics that is becomes sort of Thomas's Bible. You know, he's got underlining. He buys multiple copies. He goes to see Sowell in person, who. This is, he's now moved out to Missouri, Thomas has. The idea of Black capitalism starts to make increasing amount of sense. And I, if we want to step back from the immediate politics and the partisanship of it all, I mean, I would say the idea is that if the goal is something like Black sovereignty, not complete Black sovereignty, which is an impossibility for Thomas and for many Black nationalists, but partial sovereignty, the state is always going to be the sphere of white domination simply because white people are the majority. Thomas says this, you know, a remarkable interview he gives to Juan Williams, the journalist in 1987 in The Atlantic. And he said, you know, let's just assume you could partial power out in a kind of group way. So white people would get X amount of power, Latinos would get Y amount, and Black people, you know, Z. Who's going to come out on top? And who's going to come out on bottom? He says, on the bottom is always going to be Black people. The only other group that might be worse off are Native Americans. So this is his view of what politics is about. It's about white majoritarianism. It's a winner-take-all kind of a system. There is no room there for Black people. And to the extent that Black people would do well, it will always be because of that old specter that haunts him from his days at Yale, white benevolence. It will be because white people want to help. And that which the white hand can give, the white hand can take away. So there's this sense of dependence that is created, and a loss of independence. And so that's what politics is about. The economy is different, Thomas believes. And here, the autobiographical dimension, I think, is important. He thinks back to his grandfather. There was a whole Black community that didn't get fuel in Savannah. So what did his grandfather do? He started getting wood, and he delivered wood to Black people. And he built up a business this way by filling a niche. The capitalist economy, I mean, all economies are about unfulfilled niches. And, you know, that's what his grandfather did. And Thomas comes to see this as a story of Black possibility through participation in a Black economy. It can mean Black owned businesses. It can mean Black, you know, workers. It takes multiple forms. But that's really how he starts viewing things and how he makes his migration to the right over the course between, I'd say, from 1975, you know, on into the 1980s.
So how does Thomas eventually join the Reagan administration? And what is that experience like for him when he's essentially, you know, out and about as a conservative and gaining some prominence?
Yeah, he goes to Washington with John Danforth, who is going to become famous as a senator, becomes a bigger figure in the 90s. And he goes as a staffer for John Danforth from Missouri. But he's an up and comer, and he goes to a very famous conference called the Fairmount Conference in San Francisco of Black conservatives. And again, Juan Williams writes this story in the Washington Post. Actually, this is 1980. This is a kind of a new voice of a new generation of Black activists on the right. And it puts Thomas kind of front and center, as a spokesperson. And so he's, you know, the Reagan administration is famously interested in hiring Black people. He's scooped up right away. First in, I think it's the Department of Education, which is how he comes to work with Anita Hill. And then very quickly moves over to the EEOC, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, where he remains for the duration of the Reagan administration.
And, you know, once he is finally appointed, what sort of puts him in the position to get appointed? Because I think that, you know, even Thomas will admit that he, even though they said that people said, oh, he's the most qualified person, Thomas will be one of the first people to say that he wasn't the most qualified person. So how does he actually join the Supreme Court? And then, you know, after that, obviously he is probably one of the most famous, with the exception of maybe, you know, Robert Bork and Brett Kavanaugh in recent history, is probably one of the most famous confirmation hearings in Supreme Court history. So, you know, what actually happens there? How does that process unfold?
So, you know, Thomas, like I said, he spends the duration of the Reagan administration at the EEOC. He takes a curious path. He sometimes distances himself from the Reagan administration and talks about quite openly about the overt racists in the Reagan administration. Again, shades of Yale. He says he prefers being there because they're open about it. He knows whom he is dealing with. There's none of the kind of double dealing he's come to expect from white liberals and progressives. He makes a name for himself. He's definitely a right-wing ideologue. And then when the time comes and George H.W. Bush is elected, you know, the Bush administration is looking, this is Bush Sr., is looking at the Supreme Court, and it's quite obvious that several members of the court are quite old, and Thurgood Marshall being one of them, in failing health. And so they put, you know, they understand that they're going to have to fill Marshall's seat with another Black person. And Thomas is, you know, one of a few. There's some other people that they're looking at, but they put him on the fast track. He gets put onto the Court of Appeals, the D.C. Court of Appeals, which is kind of the last step. it's his first judicial appointment. So he doesn't have much time to kind of issue rulings that are all that controversial, though some get some notice. So when the time comes, he's kind of a natural person for the Bush administration to turn to. He's got this great story from, you know, he's from Pinpoint, Georgia. And, you know, even though he is a right-wing ideologue, pretty hardcore, he also has this black inflected conservatism. You know, he is, and for a while, I mean, he's a, the appointment is announced on June of 1991. Yeah, June or July, you know, the beginning of the summer, Marshall steps down. And the appointment is announced. And for a time, black organizations are a little bit not sure what to do. It's obvious that this guy is a right winger, but you know, he has a lot of support among black voters. Interestingly, Jim Clyburn, who's now what, the number three or number two guy in the you know the House of Representatives today, was a he was a South Carolina public government official, you know, back then. He testifies in favor of Clarence Thomas. So, you know, it's black organizations are struggling. Then this bombshell comes out and, you know, well, it starts happening in the late summer, early September of these accusations from Anita Hill. I mean, let me back up for a second. So he goes through his confirmation. And it's not the most, you know, gripping testimony, but he survives it. And so the, you know, the thought is he's going to be approved pretty widely, including by a lot of Democrats like Joe Biden. And then at the tail end of the hearings, this story that had been kind of developing quietly over the course of the summer explodes, that he is being accused of sexual harassment. By a former colleague of his, Anita Hill, who is a black woman. And then, you know, the hearings take on this, you know, it's kind of one of the weirdest moments in American politics because the nature of the testimony is sort of incredibly lurid. You have scenes of Orrin Hatch, who's this very straight-laced Mormon Utah senator, reading passages from The Exorcist involving pubic hair on Coke cans and claiming that Anita Hill fabricated her story based on readings from The Exorcist. It's all over the place. It's kind of a circus. But at the heart is the story of, you know, one woman, Anita Hill, who seems extraordinarily credible herself from an extremely conservative background in Oklahoma, Christian background, black family, and this guy, Clarence Thomas, who most of America doesn't really know. And so it gets pitted as ultimately, I mean, in many ways, but a story of race versus gender, with Thomas representing the race and Anita Hill representing her gender. And in fact, famously, this is the kind of the moment where intersectionalism as a theory is born. So that's, you know, the story. And he gets confirmed in the end. It's the closest confirmation vote in American history, 52-48. In some ways, a kind of a bellwether of where we are now, where all these confirmation votes are pretty much straight party line votes. I mean, that wasn't quite straight party line, but almost straight. And then joins the court. So that would be, yeah, in the fall of 1991.
So, you know, I think now that in our sort of recounting, Thomas is now on the Supreme Court. And I think that, you know, part of the reason why I reached out to you and wanted to talk to you about this is obviously because, you know, Thomas has been in the news, you know, front page, seemingly once every week or so. And I actually initially read this book about 2.5 years ago. I think it came out in 2019. Yeah. And, you know, of course, then I thought Thomas, oh, he's a fascinating figure, clearly very influential and important, only becoming more important as he becomes, you know, the most longest tenured member on the court. And, you know, I think before, you know, when I first learned about Thomas, what I knew about him and is what everyone knows is that he doesn't speak from the bench. Obviously, that doesn't really matter because it's not, being a justice isn't about talking, it's about writing opinions. And, you know, my sort of question for you before sort of drilling down a little bit, maybe into some of his views on the Constitution is, you know, how, I don't know, what do you think about Thomas's kind of explosion to prominence? Was it something that you expected? Is it taking you by surprise? And what do you think that it means for just the future of American politics?
Yeah, it's interesting. The experience with this book is somewhat similar to my experience with my last book. You know, we talked earlier about The Reactionary Mind. And when it first came out, it was, you know, really attacked and then had a kind of a second life in 2016 with the rise of Trump. And all of a sudden, it seemed like, oh, all those things that I was saying about the right turned out to be the case. This book, the Clarence Thomas book, was critically well received, but, you know, in reviews, very well received. But I think there was a sense that, okay, you know, this is, you know, kind of what you said, this is interesting, it's like something to watch, but, you know, it's not Clarence Thomas's court, it's, you know, John Roberts's court. And before that's, you know, Justice Scalia's court. There's always some other white dude, you know, whose court it is. And the argument of this book was, no, this is Clarence Thomas's court, you know, and not only for the reason you said, you know, it's the longest serving justice, which means he's the senior most justice. And when he's not on the same side as Roberts, he gets to decide who writes the opinions. But more important than that, he has a history, a kind of a stealth justice, of writing these opinions that are initially either ignored or dismissed, sending out positions that ultimately come to be embraced. Now, I should say, not embraced because he's, you know, the most, you know, persuasive logician or anything like that. But of course, that's never the way Supreme Court opinions get taken up. You know, it's the accident of appointments and the fact that there's, you know, just becoming an increasingly right-wing court. But nevertheless, you know, he was the one who was out of the gate on, for instance, the right to bear arms, that's a personal individual right and not something that's just a function of state militias, which is traditionally how the Second Amendment had been interpreted. A lot of his campaign finance positions were very out there, ultimately come to be embraced by and found in, you know, Citizens United. You know, now everybody's paying attention because with the overturning of Roe v. Wade, Thomas writes this concurring opinion where he says, against what Alito has said, again, not the first time he takes positions that are in opposition to his conservative brethren, he says, you know, if you overturn Roe on these grounds, here's what's going to go next. And everybody knows, you know, gay marriage, contraception, and so on. So, you know, that track record, you know, makes people pay attention. I'm not really surprised, honestly, because this is the way the story has gone, you know, thus far, and the writing was all on the wall. I mean, I said it in the book. And what needs to really be explained is not why everybody's paying attention now, but why didn't they pay attention then? Because this was all there. And, you know, as I say in the book, you know, conservative Black nationalism to scholars and people, you know, who know about this, there's nothing new in that. It is strange to have a conservative Black nationalist on the Supreme Court, and even stranger that he's now the most powerful person on the court. And most strange of all, that up until, you know, 3 or 4 weeks ago, nobody seemed to know it. And so that is, I think, the what needs to be explained.
I think, you know, this is maybe a more personal question for you, that, you know, I saw that you had an article or the op-ed in the New York Times recently. And then obviously, you know, there's been a bit more interest in Thomas. What does Thomas actually believe? Because, you know, of course, the going opinion was that he's just Scalia's puppet and that he doesn't have any thoughts of his own, which, of course, you know, is pretty racist in its own right. But now everyone is treating Thomas as like, oh, he's actually a serious, you know, he's a serious person who actually has a project of his, a constitutional project in view of his own. So I guess, you know, what has been your experience with everyone kind of, you know, waking up to this and people now having to, you know, accept this, you know, this, this new, or for them, this new recognition of what Thomas's views and beliefs are?
Wow. I mean, I'm not sure how to answer the question, what my experience of it has been. I mean, I think, yeah, I don't know. I don't know how to answer that. I guess I'm sorry. I'm just going to punt on that one.
Yeah, no, that's fair. I mean, obviously, you know, it's still, everything is also still rapidly unfolding. And I think that, you know, as with, as new, new opinions continue to come out, like the 6-3 conservative majority is going to further strengthen his position, and we'll probably see Thomas feeling even more vindicated. I guess the question I want to ask, you know, as a sort of final question to wrap things up, because I don't want to talk about every little detail about what do you think about the 14th Amendment? What do you think about the Second Amendment? People should definitely read the book. Is, you know, to what extent do you think of Thomas and his, you know, far right conservative views as coming from a sort of a reactionary sentiment, especially a feeling of just being utterly demonized, his sense of demonization at the hands of the liberal establishment?
I'll answer that in a second. But, you know, one thing I do want to say about the book and about Tom, because we didn't really get a chance to talk about his jurisprudence, is that the views that I've been talking about that he had as a younger man and so on, what's so remarkable is that those views are to be found in his Supreme Court opinions, and not just in the usual places that one might look, let's say on affirmative act, the explicit race cases. You find it in his position, for instance, on the right to bear arms, on gun rights, which has a long tradition in the Black nationalist and the in Black historical pantheon of Black arms. You find it in his ideas around campaign finance. You find it in his ideas around the takings clause. It's what's so fascinating about Thomas is just how comprehensive that vision is. And so I would encourage people, not just for my own reasons of self-interest, but also just, you know, for knowledge, to read the book, because it just shows how in case after case after case, this Black nationalist conservatism comes out. In terms of, you know, the question you're asking about reaction, I mean, I think I would spin it slightly differently, that it partakes of, I want to go back to that moment where he starts turning to the right. It really partakes of a half century politics of defeat. You know, the Black freedom struggle was defeated, not in every respect, but it was. The United States today is more racially segregated than it was under the Reagan administration. The racial wealth gap, Black voting rights, all of these markers of progress are now markers of regress. And I think at moments like that, it's extraordinarily difficult for people, you know, to believe in a project like the Left's project. Because what the Left's project is not just about freedom and equality, it's about the politics of freedom and equality. It's that you understand the political politics, and that, again, I want it in the broadest sense, not just voting, but social protests, social movements, other forms of radicalism, that you understand this as having a kind of transformational capacity and effect, a potential. And Thomas writes from a position that is the opposite of that. It's that racism is permanent and ineradicable, and that the best that Black people as a marginalized, subjugated group can hope for is in a kind of survival and withdrawal to self or the collective self. There is a kind of political quiescence that I think is, you know, extraordinarily dangerous. It's a quick final word on this. Albert Hirschman, the social scientist, had this wonderful book years ago called The Rhetoric of Reaction. And he said there's three types of reactionary argument. There's perversity, which is if you do X, you'll produce the opposite. So you try to reduce poverty, you create poverty. There's jeopardy. If you do X, you might achieve it, but you'll threaten something else. So you'll reduce poverty, black poverty, let's say, or poverty in general, but you'll destroy the family, or you'll destroy the work ethic or something like that. So that's jeopardy. But then there's a final argument that Hirschman identifies, and it's called futility. And that is, you're not going to threaten anything at all. The worst, most lethal argument against any kind of attempt at transformation is you won't do anything at all. And I think part of the reason why that argument is so dangerous is that it has a certain left-wing version of it, which is the structural nature of anything, racism, sexism, and that agency is incapable of doing anything about that, whether it's individual or collective agency. And Thomas is that moment, is the futilitarian moment of reactionary thought. And for that reason, because it is so appealing in a way, not just to the right, but to the left, I think that's really what he speaks to is that moment in American politics that we're in.
Yeah, that's actually a really interesting observation. The sort of the feudal, Thomas's kind of feudal perspective on, not feudal, but futile perspective on politics. You know, the last question that I want to ask you is if there's anything new that you're working on, either, you know, related to this project. You mentioned at the beginning that you thought you were done with the right. So if so, what else? Or if not, you know, what issues are you still looking at?
Yeah, I mean, I'm working a lot now on political economy and ideas about capitalism from basically Adam Smith onward. So I'm knee deep in that and trying to, you know, resist weighing in on every latest blip of
fair.
Not right.
Well, thank you so much for being on the New Books Network. It was great talking to you. And if people go to the show notes, they'll find a link to the book. I highly recommend people read it. It's a highly readable book and very interesting. So thank you.
Thank you very much.